versus Kingston. Council may approach. Morning, Mr. Belmont.
Morning, Your Honors. Justices, may it please the court, counsel. My name is Ben Belmont, and I represent the appellant, Laura Kingston, in this matter. This time, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. This appeal arises from a decree of dissolution entered on May 27th, 2021. But let's get to the issue of whether this court has jurisdiction to hear this appeal.
Thank you.
This court does have jurisdiction unless you consider this motion to reconsider, which was filed 7 days after the court entered an order amending the decree, as the functional equivalent of a valid motion to alter or amend. The case law does define a motion to reconsider. That's what the appellees filed, as nothing more than an invitation to the court to consider exercising its inherent power to vacate or modify its own judgment. In the absence of an applicable rule to the contrary, a motion asking the court to exercise its inherent power to vacate or modify its own judgment does not terminate the time for taking an appeal. This court may treat what they filed, a motion reconsider, as a motion to alter or amend if it was filed within 10 days,
which it was, yeah.
And it seeks to substantive alteration of the judgment, which it does not.
Why do you say that? I mean, there was a pretty significant change to the student loan debt, wasn't
but
there?
Look what they're seeking to, in essence, change the theory of their case. They are now asking that the appellant is disabled, and let's make her file an application with the government to have these student loans released.
But my recollection is that the trial judge actually referenced the disability originally, and that's why the original decree, I think, came out the way it did with regard to the student loan, only accounting for, what, $25,000
sure.
of it is marital. So I think the trial judge did actually consider the fact that she might be able to have the remainder of the loan discharged because of her disability. So that was an issue that was tried on the new motion, or the initial motion for new trial. That issue came up. The judge reversed course and entered a new order substantially altering the original. So why wouldn't the motion be affecting a substantial issue?
I think you have to look at what their motion, what they filed in this case. And what they filed is trying to change their theory of the case. I tried to go back and research this because I waited 23 days before I decided to file a notice of appeal because I didn't quite know what this motion to reconsider was. It wasn't titled a motion to alter or amend, but it doesn't have to be titled a motion to alter or amend. But then I went through the 38 paragraphs and thought about what they're specifically asking this court now to do, which was different than just change the amount of the judgment. Then I went back and looked at the federal rules in this case, because again, there's not much by state, but our statute 251329 is modeled after Federal Rules of Civil Procedure 59E. And I looked at some of the Eighth Circuit cases and how they look at a motion to alter or amend the judgment. And they state in Innovative Home Health Care versus PT, it's 141 Fed 3rd, 1284, a motion to alter or amend pursuant to Rule 59E serves the limited function of correcting manifest errors of law of fact or to present newly discovered evidence. Rule 59E does not afford an opportunity to present evidence or legal argument that could have been offered prior to the entry of the judgment. These arguments that they're making now could have been presented to the district court, but that would have changed the theory of their case. Their theory of the case was that the appellant wasn't disabled, even though Social Security said she's disabled, she had a private health carrier said she's disabled, and the court ultimately said she's disabled. So they decide in this motion to reconsider to decide we're going to change the theory of the case, and we're going to ask in, and I can't remember the number of paragraphs that you're going to request, that the court actually require the appellant to file an application with the government to get her student loans released. A motion under Rule 59 is not intended to routinely give litigants a second bite at the apple, but to afford an opportunity for relief in extraordinary circumstances. Your Honors, that's what we were dealing with before, because if I don't file my notice of intent to appeal, I blow my chance to appeal if this order, if this motion is not considered to be a tolling motion. So
you both are out, right?
We both are.
You both are out, because I don't know that either of you have filed since the 7/30/21 order that denied the motion to reconsider. Unless an appeal was filed within 30 days after that order, you may both be out, right?
No, because that there's case law out there that says that if motion was not heard, and I think it's this court, motion not heard on its merits, because you didn't appeal it, the court could still, if you vacated that order because the court did have jurisdiction, then it could be heard. So
on what basis could we vacate it? Simply because the court was wrong in determining it didn't have jurisdiction?
Correct. And this motion wasn't heard on the motion to alter, motion reconsider wasn't heard on its merits. So again, the defendants who vehemently argued at trial that the appellant was not disabled could have presented this information about dischargeability of the student loan debt at the trial, but it would have been contrary to their theory of the case. And therefore, again, they can't get a second bite at the apple by now filing this motion to reconsider.
So you would agree that the only way we can take jurisdiction over this appeal is to determine that that motion for reconsideration was not a tolling motion, that it did not seek substantial relief.
That's correct.
Okay.
It's seeking to substantially alter
the prior order.
Correct. It's seeking something different that they had an opportunity to bring up at the time and failed to do so. When we initially filed this appeal, the issues of this appeal dealt with custody, income for purposes of child support, alimony, division of defendants' RSUs, and appreciation on defendants' claim to premarital assets. In custody, as far as the issue of the custody was concerned, as I've indicated in the past, it doesn't have to be fair to the parties, it has to be what's in the best interest of the minor children. And when you review the record, I think clearly that would be in the best interest of the minor children that mom be awarded physical custody. Last week, this court came down with reversed the district court's determination in Rodas versus Franco. It was a modification case, but you went back and you conducted a thorough de novo review of the record, you reapprised the evidence anew, and you considered the best interest is set forth in the statute and under Nebraska jurisprudence as to what's in the best interest of the minor children, and concluded the trial court abused its discretion. I submit to you a reading of this record, de novo on the record, where you reappraise the evidence, would indicate that it is clearly in the best interest of these two minor children, ages 15 and 5, that the mother be awarded physical custody. Mother was medically disabled, but has been the primary care parent. It's not a situation where the party's co-parent. It's not a situation where after the divorce, the primary care parent's gonna go out and have to get a job. Mom's gonna be there in the same capacity as she was prior to The divorce. This is a situation where dad has admittedly a demanding job. Mom continue to be home and provide care, especially for the youngest, who she hasn't been away with, I mean, for more than two nights in a row. The district court did a proper analysis in determining both decision-making, giving mom legal and educational decision-making, but failed to do the same in determining the physical custody. There are some other errors that the district court had made as far as determining child support. I will, in its defense, the district court's defense, it did not have the benefit of a case called Vanderveer versus Vanderveer, which had come down recently. But it, the Supreme Court since then has indicated that the RSUs are going to be used for purposes of child support. The district court did not use the RSUs for purposes of child support in this case. Another interesting issue was there was a 2008 RSU stock grant. The parties got married in 2009. The RSUs take 4 years to vest. This court didn't give my client any interest in those, even though the appellee indicated that they take 4 years to vest and he's providing services. And we're there for future services. If they're for future services, you still have to use the Davidson time rule and make application to those. As far as the issue on the alimony, the court ordered no alimony. It was an 11-year marriage. My client had been placed on disability for 9 of the 11 years, yet continued to financially contribute 50%. She continued to care for the children and the home during that period. The evidence shows that defendant's career at UP had taken off during the course of this marriage, and that he was earning in excess of $200,000 at the time of the trial as a director of compensation. He was able to focus his career during the course of this marriage while my client did everything else in the household. And her earnings through disability are stagnant.
How can you guide us on approaching, you know, abuse of discretion standard of review on these kinds of things, right? I mean, it has to be such a wacky decision, basically. I mean, that I think that's what our Supreme Court is telling us, that abuse of discretion is a very, very difficult standard to meet. And for us to find that, we might disagree with what a trial court did, but can we say it's an abuse of discretion?
If you look at the record in this case, the evidence was clear, based on the evidence, it was clearly untenable that we're going to do equal parenting time under these situations. They didn't co-parent. This is, and if you look at the facts, look at the ages, especially of the youngest, it would indicate that it would, the record was clear that what was in the best interest. And there would have been, or there is, an abuse of discretion.
Thank you.
I'll reserve the remaining portion of my time.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. Proceed. May it please the court, your honors, my name is Adam Richard Little of Nebraska Legal Group, and I, along with my co-counsel, Hannah Summers, represent the appellee, Trevor Kingston, in this matter. As we are before the court today on an original appeal of a dissolution of marriage decree, there are several issues for this court to address. I'm going to go first to the issue of jurisdiction, and then with the remaining time, there are a number of substantive issues as well as a cross appeal that I will address. Now, before we move into that, it is important to recognize, as Judge Bishop pointed out, the standard of review in this case is an abuse of discretion. And that is, in fact, a very high standard. It requires the reasons or rulings of the trial court be so clearly untenable insofar as they unfairly deprive a litigant of a substantial right and a just result. Now, with that context in mind, I'm going to go head on into the most significant issue for this court is the lack of jurisdiction in this case. The motion to alter amend is by itself a tolling motion with respect to the time to file an appeal. However, it is a terminating motion with respect to a notice of appeal that was filed. And that's what occurred here, Your Honors. The decree of dissolution was entered on May 27th of 2021. And with respect to the remaining dates here, they are 2021 unless I clarify otherwise. That decree was entered and the appellant Laura filed a timely motion to alter amend on June 3rd. That ruling came down on June 14th. At that point, the notice of appeal period began. However, the appellee Trevor filed a motion to reconsider on June 21st, within those 10 days as permitted for a motion to alter amend. Now, we're not going to kid ourselves about the caption. Caption was a motion to reconsider. However, the case law is very clear. The caption is irrelevant. It is the intent and what the substance of the motion requests. And the Nebraska Supreme Court has found in Strong v. Omaha Construction Industry Pension Plan in 2005 that a motion for reconsideration can be the functional equivalent of a motion to alter or amend. The key consideration for this court is what the effect of that motion requests. And as Judge Bishop correctly pointed out, the change, the significant change in the amended decree is what was being sought to be addressed in that motion to reconsider, which we do treat and consider as a motion to alter amend. The court was also made aware of that at hearing on that motion that we were asking to substantively alter or amend the judgment. When that amended decree came down, it drastically changed the division of property in this case by a swing of almost $75,000. That judgment, the amended decree in itself became a new judgment. And so the request to change that was an alter or amend.
So if that's true, and the court did not rule on that prior to the notice of appeal being filed, then there was not a final order yet at the time your appeal was filed, right?
That is precisely correct.
Or the appeal was filed, not your appeal.
Right.
That precisely correct. And what happens, that notice of appeal is terminated. That is explicitly set forth in Nebraska Revised Statute 25-1912, which is what provides this court with jurisdiction and addresses the effect of a tolling motion. And 1912 specifically indicates that a notice of appeal that was filed regardless of the timing with respect to a motion to alter amend is terminated until ruling on that motion to alter amend.
But could this be a problem for you from the standpoint that the court nevertheless had a hearing, you know, after the notice of appeal was filed, had a hearing and issued an order now denying the motion for reconsideration from which nobody has appealed?
That is correct. And the appellee concedes that that is a fatal effect with respect to the cross appeal. And in fact, that is the position that the appellee is asserting here today in light of the jurisdictional defect. Simply put, there are two outcomes here. On one hand, the court considers that there was no final order or that the motion to reconsider was not a tolling motion, the notice of appeal was perfected, and we have jurisdiction to address this appeal.
Did you look at the issue Mr. Belmont was talking about, if that ruling on 7/30/21 was not on the merits versus on the merits, it was dismissed, does that make any difference? Can you point us to anything in that regard?
I am unfamiliar with the case law that Mr. Belmont is referring to, and we would actually posit that the motion to deny that is a denial. That order is resolved. I would point the court to Beckman v. McAndrew, 16 Nebraska Appellate 217, a case from 2007, where there was an equivalent motion to alter amend. In that case, it was a motion to dismiss and vacate. However, a notice of appeal was filed prior to the ruling on that motion, and this court determined that that notice of appeal had no effect. And because no later notice of appeal was filed, the appeal was dismissed. And that's what we believe should occur here.
What was that site again? 16 NAB
217.
Yep, NAB App 217 from 2007.
Where does that leave? If we find there's no jurisdiction because the appeal was filed too early, where does that leave you?
It leads us to a final order was entered on July 30th, 2011, resolving all matters in this. No proper appeal was perfected from that July 30th order, and the case is settled and resolved
of
that date.
You're both done.
That is correct.
There's no further appeals available to you.
That is correct. And that is our position that regardless of the outcome here, That order is from the court's previous term. We don't believe the court would have jurisdiction to vacate that. And the court, I forget the specific citation. I know there's a case dealing with whether or not a court could extend the time to appeal by virtue of vacating an order where there was a defect. That actually may be the Beckman v. McAndrew case.
So you're stuck with that $100,000 of student loan debt?
We are. Regrettably, we are, but we understand in the context of this, if the court doesn't have jurisdiction, there's nothing that can be done. And we don't believe that the district court has any recourse here to address that failure to do that.
And you just soon not get to any of the issues that Mr. Belmont has raised?
we are more than happy to address any of those issues head on. And in fact, we believe that we prevail on the substantive merits. But we're not going to dance around this issue and pretend this court has jurisdiction to decide something it does not. For those reasons, we believe that the outcome is what it is, and that this appeal at this point has no merit because the appellant failed to perfect their appeal following the ruling on that order. What should have been done here, plain and simple, was a second notice of appeal filed, just to be sure. Since that wasn't done, that is a choice that was made, and unfortunately, that is not something that will.
And that would have been within 30 days following July 30th.
Right? That is correct.
Of last year.
That is correct. Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so since those 30 days have elapsed from that July 30th order, there's no appealability from that order. It is final. Now, in the event this court does consider it has jurisdiction for whatever variety of reasons we've already discussed, I do want to address some of the substantive issues. The first thing, I think it makes some sense to work backwards here with respect to the cross appeal, because that does directly imply the issue of the student loan debt.
Before you do that, could you address the custody issue real quick?
Certainly.
Please.
We believe that this court's the trial court's custody determination, when reviewed de novo on the record, there is no abuse of discretion. The trial court went through and analyzed the factors, and in the original decree specifically included determination of the parties' ability to work together or not in some instances, and specifically stated, and I'm paraphrasing a little bit here, that the court had considered the entirety of the evidence in reaching this conclusion and set forth the legal analysis in how it applied those factors. Now, there is no longer a presumption of what type of custody is appropriate, and so the court is really guided by what is in the children's best interests. And the appellant here bears the burden of proving that there is an abuse of discretion. Our argument here is simply that the standard of review is controlling here and dispositive. The appellant fails to meet her burden of proof. Simply, she uses the same tactic on appeal that she used at trial, to besmirch Trevor, to try and show what a terrible guy he is without focusing as much on the parenting aspects. A personal dislike and a desire to drag him through the mud are insufficient basis to meet an abuse of discretion. And Laura's brief and her argument rely almost exclusively on her own testimony. Now, the trial court, as the trier of fact, has the exclusive ability to consider and weigh the credibility of the witnesses and determination of who the court believes in those circumstances. And we believe that is what the court did here.
Mr. Belmont argued that this case was similar to the Rodas case that was released a week ago. Do you agree with that?
I apologize. I am not familiar with that case. So I would defer to the court's own interpretation of that specific case law.
Thank you.
And I would also, again, point to Markovitz v. Rogers, which is 267 Nebraska 456, which does contain the specific provision that in contested custody cases where material issues of fact are in great dispute, which there's little doubt that is what is occurring here, the standard of review and deference granted to the trial court who heard and observed the witnesses is often dispositive.
Mr. Little, could you address Mr. Belmont's argument about not all income was included in the child support calculation in terms of Trevor's income?
Absolutely. And I'm going to cut right to the chase on that this child support proceedings are equitable, and the nature and the merit a flexible approach. And that's what the court did here. The trial court needs to look at the income available to the parties for purposes of calculating child support. And the Vanderveer case, contrary to Mr. Belmont's position, is actually right on point with what we're looking at and can be distinguished from the facts here as to what occurred. In that case, the person who's receiving the restricted stock units, or RSUs, testified that he routinely cashed them out and used the funds from those cashed out stock units to fund their lifestyle, and in fact, had a more lavish lifestyle because they chose to do so. Now contrast that with the facts in this case, where Mr. Kingston specifically testified he did not cash them out and he treated those stocks as portion of his retirement. Now, there is some income reported on his tax returns from the transfer of those. As those stock units become vested, there is a tax implication. What happens is those shares are awarded, 500 shares, and 35% of those shares are sold to pay for the taxes. The remaining shares are awarded. That sale of shares initiates a taxable event. That income is shown on Mr. Kingston's tax returns. However, it's phantom income. And what I would point this court to is to consider it analogous to when a subchapter S corporation provides a distribution to cover corporate tax liability. It's phantom income. It's never money that actually goes in his pocket. It's just on paper to show that.
But then you would look at the retained earnings of the corporation to make sure that there's not an excessively high amount of retained earnings being withheld.
That is correct.
Because we don't want those games played, right? Mm-hmm. We don't want people retaining earnings so that they can avoid having that included as income for child support purposes. So that, this would be similar, that he's choosing not to cash them out, but they are available to him.
They are available to him, and to extend on that a little bit, I would also analogize this to a retirement account in the sense of if the court were to consider additional income here, there would be an opportunity for a double dip for Ms. Kingston in that when he does cash in those shares, that generates additional income. The only income that was reported was the taxable portion of the transfer of those shares. No actual money exchanged hands. If he wanted to get money, to have money to pay child support for that, he would have to cash in additional shares, which creates an additional taxable event. So the money that's reported is not money that ever went into Mr. Kingston's hands. The trial court recognized that properly, and that is distinguished from Vanderveer because they were not cashed in.
But by holding them as opposed to cashing them out and paying the taxes and having that accounted for, he's in essence able to delay quite a considerable amount of money until, say, after his children have reached the age of majority, and then cash them out, and she gets no benefit from that, or the children get no benefit from that.
They don't in the sense of calculation of child support. However, to the extent that those are an asset, those assets were partially divided in this case. And so we look at this, the fact that it is a stock as opposed to a tax deferred account, they can both be treated as a form of deferred compensation for purposes of saving for retirement. And the court does have discretion in applying the guidelines. They are a rebuttable presumption. And by showing to the court he does not have that income available, but instead is withholding that, we believe that Trevor rebutted the presumption that that should be included in his income.
Did that go into an actual retirement account?
The shares are held in an E-Trade account. So that account was partially divided as part of the court's equitable division. It is not in a tax-deferred account. So I apologize if there's any confusion in how I parlayed that.
Thank you.
Very briefly, in conclusion, I would ask the court to consider the briefs with respect to the division of the property and note that the appellant only assigned error with respect to the classification and not the division. And finally, the court ruled correctly in its alimony ruling. Specifically, the court, the standard here is dispositive with respect to whether it is untenable. And with that, I would stand on my argument. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
How much time do we have for rebuttal?
2 minutes and 10 seconds, Your Honor.
2 minutes and 10 seconds, Mr. Belmont.
Your Honors, first, regarding the RSUs and not being included in his income, that's a distinction without a difference. The fact that he doesn't cash those in doesn't matter. It's like they're still on his gross income. It's like putting them in a savings account that I'm going to use at some point in time later. It's not a retirement account. So that that analogy doesn't work, and This is similar, if not almost identical, to Vanderveer, with the exception of in Vanderveer, they're cashed in. This individual elects not to cash them in. I'm surprised now that their position is we don't have an appeal. They filed this motion. They filed this confusing motion to reconsider this, and having the court and everybody rely on whether that's going to be a tolling motion or not. And the court did enter an order, but entered the order, not that it ruled on the merits of the case, but entered the order that it didn't have jurisdiction to hear the motion. Bryson versus Isabel, Bryson L versus Isabel L, 302 Neb 145. It is, well, the outcome is that the appeal was denied, and they ran out, they didn't extend the time in which to file an appeal. That case, the first motion indicated that the court did rule on the merits of that first motion. So in this case, the court motion to alter amend. In this case, the court never ruled on their motion. Now, I'm not sure what if they would have got there and then said, I'm going to withdraw the motion, and you're out of time, you didn't appeal. They set it for, they filed the motion on the 21st. They set it for July 29th. My appeal time would have ran out July 14th. So
at the hearing on July 29th, am I recalling correctly, in the back and forth between counsel and Judge Burns, there was, he indicated he was going to treat this as a motion to alter or amend. Did he say that to you?
No, he in the, not the July 29th hearing. He treated their initial motion for order nunk-pro-tunk at the first hearing, and that's as a motion to alter or amend. So this second motion reconsideration, which I don't think tolls anything, is just now a successive, could be considered to be just a successive motion, and why they didn't bring it up.
Thank you.
Your Honors, I would respectfully request that we be granted the relief set forth in our brief, that the decision of the district court be reversed, and that we would request the relief.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you
for being here. Very difficult issues. Our apologies that our jurisprudence is so unclear.
Yeah. Case is submitted. We'll take it under advisement. Thank you for being here. Council is excused, and we are adjourned.